Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minnig.
Everyone, my name is Jacob Minnig, host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today, we have a very special episode with Charles Fogarty. Charles is a former Navy SEAL with 12 years of experience in special operations as a SEAL, sea, air, and land operator. While in operation, Charles's expertise included combat medicine, explosives training, armed and unarmed combat, teaching and instructing, and range safety operations. Throughout this awesome and amazing episode, Charles will get into his passions and motivations on why he became a Navy SEAL and what his journey was like being a SEAL, going through his missions and the different types of stress that he went through. Charles will then tell us about his recovery story, what led to his certain issues when he got out of the Navy, and again, how he overcame his addictions and obstacles in life to become the man he is today in recovery. So without further ado, let's begin. Well, again, Charlie, thank you so much for being on the show, man. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. I was humbled that you asked me.
Yeah, and this will be a first. I've never had a Navy SEAL on my show. So again, I know we're in for an amazing fun ride.
Yeah. Okay. Hopefully we'll see. Don't play it up too much. I don't want
to get here. Okay. Like, I got to ask you, because I've known a lot of people who join the Navy and they would go down different career routes. First of all, like, what made you want to join the Navy? And did you always know you want to be a Navy SEAL?
Yeah, for quite a while. I'd say since about sixth or seventh grade, I was pretty, fun site focused on becoming a SEAL. Like, I knew that was what I wanted to do. And, you know, and to answer your question, kind of the 2020 hindsight armchair quarterback answer is, you know, I wanted to repair my wounded, damaged ego, you know, build some self-esteem. That was really why I wanted to become a SEAL. But at the time, you know, I wanted to fight in war, to be honest. You know, I wanted to be part of the best of the best. And, you know, I kind of saw SEALs as being kind of Supermen, you know, and I wanted to be a Superman as well. So that was kind of what sparked that interest early on.
So, Charlie, man, I got to ask you, have you seen, obviously, the movie The Navy SEALs with Charlie Sheen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How much of that is actually true?
Oh, well, you know what? I cannot give you a good response to that one, Jacob, because I don't think I've seen that movie since I was probably like 13 or 14 years old. So I honestly could not even give you an opinion on that. I know that usually when that movie is brought up amongst the other SEALs and in the SEAL teams, it's brought up as a joke, you know, so it's not brought up and as a serious, you know, but I'm sure that for some of the older guys that kind of came before me, I'm sure it did motivate some of them, you know, so yeah. Mm-hmm.
So help walk me through the process, because I've had people talk to me like, yeah, man, like, I joined the Navy and I wanted to be a SEAL, but then later I found out I didn't really have the athleticism or the conditioning to be one. Did you have to go through, obviously, like a certain amount of tests to, again, prove that you're, I guess, Navy SEAL material?
Yeah. Yeah, you do. So, you know, they've come a long way. You know, when I joined and how the way it is now, I believe it's still this way is, so, you know, you walk into a recruiting office and, you know, you tell them that you want to be a SEAL, and what they do is, you know, they'll have you enlist with what's called, like a SEAL challenge, I believe. So, you know, a while back in the Navy, we call them rates as opposed to MOSs. Like, I believe the Army and Marine Corps, they usually call their jobs MOSs, and we call them rates in the Navy. And in the past, you know, people would go through boot camp, go to their rate, have their job, and then put in a package for SEAL training. But now there's actually this whole SEAL challenge program in place where you enlist on the premise that you're going to go right to SEAL training. SEALs have their own rate now, called SO or special operator. But yes, there is, to answer your question, you know, you do have to meet certain physical qualifications, you know, just basic health standards. And then there is a what they call the PST, or a pre-screening test. And this is consists of a swim, push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, and a mile and a half run. And then there is also what they call, I can't remember the acronym now, but it's like a psychological test that is supposed to kind of assess for mental resiliency. And basically what they do is they kind of look at how competitive your PST scores are with how well you score on the psychological examination. And assuming you meet all the other criteria, then you're kind of guaranteed this SEAL contract. So you're guaranteed to at least get a chance to try out. But needless to say, you know, there's still a process to go through until you actually make it to SEAL training. And then, you know, there's a fairly high attrition rate, you know, so the vast majority of people don't end up making it through, but that's kind of the process to get started.
I'm assuming you have to swim a lot for the first test, right? Being a SEAL.
No, the first test is just it's a 500 yard swim. So, I mean, that might, if you're not a swimmer,
that's actually a lot for me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, when you actually get to SEAL training, you know, you're doing 2 mile swims, and then you actually have up to I believe it was a 5.5 mile ocean swim. So in the grand scheme of things, 500 yards isn't too far. So
what would happen? I'm sure this has happened. What would happen if a guy would just cramp up or get too tired in the middle of like training? Would there be like guys in jet skis throwing them buoys or whatever?
Yeah. So they have all sorts of, you know, cause you know, SEAL training is inherently, you know, very dangerous. And
yeah,
has actually been a, you know, recently a topic in mainstream headlines as well, as a result of a SEAL candidate recently dying in training. They do a good job. They have a lot of safety parameters in place, and the instructors are very well trained. And yeah, during those swims, you know, they have safety boats out there, they have jet skis, you know, and all those sort of things are in place in the event that they have an emergency come up. So
let's say if you fail a test, whatever, Do the SEALs give you another chance to like make up for it and pass it?
Yeah. So usually you get a certain number of tries to pass a test. And then, you know, if you have failed something so you know, there's certain things in, in SEAL training, you know, it's broken down into two parts. You have BUDS, which stands for Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training. And that's kind of, that's really the filtering process where they weed out the majority of guys. And if you make it through BUDS, you're not a SEAL yet. You then actually move on to SEAL qualification training, which is about another, you know, 7 to 8 months of more specialized training until you actually become a Navy SEAL. But that, like I said, that BUDS pipeline is where they kind of filter everyone out. And in BUDS, you have, you know, several training evolutions, and several of these are pass fail. You know, certain time constraints or whatever. And yeah, for just about every evolution, you're given more than one chance to pass. And if you have kind of surpassed that limit, then they'll do what's called like a review board. And they'll kind of look at the individual, look at, you know, how is he physically, how is he ranked amongst the class? And they'll kind of make a determination. Are we going to roll this guy back a class and give him another chance to maybe try, or are we just going to release them from the program? So that's kind of how it works.
Okay. So if you pass BUDS, let's say, is there like a high percentage chance that you will make it through, or is that just kind of a difficult answer?
No, that's a good question. Yeah. So the majority, and BUDS is broken down into three phases. And the majority of people are washed out in first phase, and the majority of people wash out prior to what's known as Hell Week. So Hell Week is kind of the major test gate of BUDS, if you will. So most people that make it through Hell Week will go on to graduate and become Navy SEALs. But certainly not all of them. There's still, you know, it's why there's that saying in the SEAL teams, the only easy day was yesterday, because it really just, you know, it never really lets up. It always kind of just gets harder. You know, you're even when you make it to a SEAL team, Jacob, I mean, you can have what's called your trident. That's the warfare device that you get pinned on your chest when you graduate. You can have that removed
Wow.
at any time in your career. So it It really doesn't ever end, you know. But the majority of guys, if they make it through Hell Week and they make it through BUDS, they will go on to be Navy SEALs. But every class will certainly have a few guys that will, you know, for one reason or another, they won't make it all the way through.
Okay. You know, the reason I know a little bit about this is because I love watching Joe Rogan, and I don't know if you watch his podcast.
I'm not like a religious Joe Rogan watcher, but I've seen a couple here and there. Yeah.
And he has this friend named Jocko.
Oh yeah, Jocko. Yep.
Yep. Navy SEAL.
Yep.
Yeah, so I love listening to his stories because he has his own podcast talking about like life advice and everything. And
Oh sure,
yeah.
yeah.
So yeah, he's awesome.
Yeah. I never Jocko was a little bit before my time, but I mean every SEAL knows who Jocko is, yeah.
Yep. And he always talks about buds and the SEALs and the training
Sure, yeah.
process. And yeah, so. So, Charlie, when you're a Navy SEAL, is it just like any military branch where you like you choose a particular avenue, right? Or a specialization in the SEALs?
So you know, yes, you sort of do, but in a way, you know, SEALs, you really kind of have to be a jack of all trades, in a sense, you know. So you're certainly trained in kind of all of the aspects of warfare, you know, and special operations. But usually, you know, when you check into a SEAL team, you have different roles within the platoon, you know, just like you would, I'm assuming, in regular Army, Marine Corps, infantry, you know, you have snipers, breachers, medics, and you know, so usually guys will kind of pick one route and will kind of that'll be kind of their specialty. But some guys have multiple specialties as well. So you're not you know, just because you're qualified to be a sniper doesn't mean that you're also not a medic. Or like for myself, I was a medic, but I was also a breacher. So
Okay.
Oftentimes, you know, guys do, they'll kind of cling on to one thing, you know, that they're really passionate about, and then that'll kind of be like their niche within the platoon.
Did you have a particular passion of yours?
Well, you know, for me, you know, I was a medic, so that was always a, you know, a big thing for me, 'cause for guys that want to be medics, we after SQT, we actually go to the Army Special Operations Command at in Bragg, North Carolina, and we go through it's almost we were there for like almost a year. It's a long course. So it's and then you know when you get to your platoon, that's you know like your role within the platoon is being a medic. But you know I also enjoyed being a breacher, and breaching is like a you know, explosives, mechanical breaching, you know, breaking in through locked, you know, barricaded doors and whatnot. And yeah, and then another one of my specialties was also just the I had a background in strike boxing and Muay Thai. So the combatives, you know, I would say if there was one area that like I probably put a lot of time into you know working with other guys with, it was with the combatives portion. And I actually would then later in my career go on to be a combatives instructor for a couple of years. So
That's awesome. Because I'm also a jiu-jitsu practitioner, so that's why I
oh
like
nice.
Jocko and Joe
Awesome. Yeah, yeah,
Rogan.
yeah, yeah. Good for you, man. That I, you know, I just got in, you know, I of course, you know, did a little bit of rolling throughout my career
Oh, nice.
within the combat, you know, you do it within combatives and it's part of the training, you know. But I always just kind of clung to the striking stuff. But I actually I was getting big into rolling this past year, but then my dad actually passed away
Oh, no.
about a year ago, and when he passed, kind of put my gym membership on hold at the fight gym and just haven't gotten back into it, man. But I really was starting to get, you know, rolling's addictive in its own
It
way, man.
is.
Kind of,
It
you know,
is.
I liked it because it was a lot less anxiety than boxing, you know, like and it's nice not having the headaches, you know, from getting hit in the head and everything. So
Hell yeah, man. Well, hey, if you ever want to roll, let me know.
yeah, for sure.
Get you back into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I guess like jiu-jitsu in itself too is so good for like self-defense and obviously close quarters combat and penetration, just all that great stuff.
Yeah, no, our combatives program, you know, I mean, man, we could do a whole podcast on combatives,
Yep.
but, you know, because like I said, that was my job and passion for a long time, and we put a lot of work into revamping that combatives program. It's evolved quite a bit throughout the years in the SEAL teams, you know. And yeah, we utilize jiu-jitsu primarily from a positional perspective, you know, like we want guys to know, you know, how to remain on top, and you know, we want to get back to our feet, because ultimately as special operators, we have so much equipment on us, you know, we want to avoid going down to the ground at all costs. So, you know, the idea is to stay on your feet as much as possible. So
now, like, the main job of a SEAL team is to, like, meet their objective by getting to a location or a certain area very quietly but quickly.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of different mission sets for the SEAL teams, you know, and that's where, you know, the SEAL is an acronym for sea, air, and land. And you know, that just kind of represents the different, different insertion areas. But yeah, you know, we do all sorts of stuff, you know, but the premise, I guess it can be summed up exactly what you just said there. We try to get somewhere quietly, sneakily, and stealthily, and then carry out whatever the objective might be, and then leave there quietly and stealthily. So,
yeah, I know in some of Joe Rogan's podcasts and Jocko's, I would always love listening to the Vietnam veteran SEALs, and I'm telling their insane stories about how they would meet their objectives and go into the jungle quietly and not be seen. It was always very fascinating stuff.
Oh yeah, I'm right with you there, man. I was telling you about that period where I really started to get interested in the SEALs, and I, especially the Vietnam War in particular,
yes.
I had a real fascination with it, because there was
Me
just
too.
Something about, you know, that idea of, you know, special operations, the SEALs and Green Berets and the CIA task force, just, you know, four, five, six guys, you know, alone and unafraid in the jungle conducting these incredibly high risk operations, you know. So yeah, it's those. I mean, I get goosebumps honestly right now as I'm just talking about it. You know, those were some brave warriors for sure.
Yeah, and again, not to get like too much off topic, but man, fucking A, like the SEALs had it right. I think the Vietnam approach. And again, I don't want to get too much into it because that could be like five podcasts or God knows what. But I just hearing some of the veterans explain their approach to the war and everything, SEALs had it right. The SEALs had it right, and that's all I'll say. Yeah. So Charlie, so when you were starting to go on missions, do you mind telling us what parts of the country was, like Afghanistan or somewhere in the Middle East, that most of your missions took place?
So all of my missions, combat missions were Afghanistan. Yes.
Okay. Okay. And not to pry too much, but again, I can't imagine what you went through in those situations, and just the stress, the anxiety, possibly just, you know, completing your objective and then worrying about like the man on your left and your right. Do you mind telling us a little bit about that, or what that maybe had an effect on, or how it affected you?
Yeah, well, you know, you train so much to become a Navy SEAL. I mean, the whole process, you know, from day one till you get your Trident, which I, you know, mentioned earlier, that warfare device, you know, assuming you don't get rolled at all, which you know, is pretty rare. Most people will get rolled at some point in the pipeline. It takes about 2 years, you know, so it's 2 years of intense training. And then, you know, you actually get to your SEAL platoon, and you know, you have you know, what we call a professional development period, then a platoon workup. You know, like there's just so much training that goes into it. And you know, they've been at this, you know, for a long time now, and the training is you know, the best out there. So it's, you know, it's so realistic that, you know, by the time you know, you get there, I guess you're just so well prepared that I always just kind of saw it like a sparring match, if you will, you know, like get yourself to prepare. I mean, I even remember before mission, sometimes if I knew we were patrolling, like I'd stretch, you know, I'd make sure I was hydrating and fueling properly, you know, and rehearsing stuff in my head, you know, just like I would before, you know, a fight or a sparring match. And then you go out there and do it, you know, and then of course, you know, as time goes on, and again, you know, there are guys with much more combat experience than I have in the SEAL teams. So on a grand scheme of things, you know, like my combat experience was minimal compared to a lot of the SEALs that you probably hear about in the mainstream media. But for myself, you know, I remember, you know, like the first mission, my first time, you know, it was like, I just, you know, you're just, you know, you don't really know what to expect. I remember I was like the turret gunner on our first op. And, you know, I needed to take a piss. And, you know, I was like asking my old guy, you know, I was like, is it all right if I go out, you know, cause like, to me, I'm thinking like there's IEDs, you know, like,
yes.
I don't really have like a good conception yet of like what it's really like, you know? And, but then of course, like the more, operations you go on, you know, you get more comfortable with it. And, you know, for us, we were fortunate in that, deployment to Afghanistan, that first one where we got to do quite a bit of, targeting, which is kind of like, what you want to do as a Navy SEAL, you know, like going after high value targets, bad guys, you know, kind of like what you see in the movies, you know, running up to a building, clearing the building, you know, locating the person and that sort of thing. So, but yeah, you know, I just, there were certainly, you know, I'd say on that deployment, two experiences that in particular had a lasting impact on me. But for the most part, you know, most combat operations, they're just kind of like another training evolution, you know? And I'm sure, you know, the stress, you know, it certainly subconsciously takes its toll over time, you know, but yeah, for myself, it was really just kind of two operations in particular that really kind of stuck with me. Yeah. To answer your question.
So going back to the first one, you said you were the gunner.
Yes.
Is that a 50 cal then machine gun or?
Yes. Yep, 50 cal.
So, and again, I'm so naive to this stuff. So, like, it's heavy, but you can still, like, kind of carry it around and move
well,
to...
Well, it's actually... Certain... No, you don't carry it around. So, you're actually in an all-armored vehicle, and you actually control it.
A tank.
Well, it's not a tank. Okay. You might, you know, a civilian might describe it as a tank. It might
see how naive I am.
Hey, no, it's all good, man. But you actually control it from in the inside, like a video game. So, you have, like, a screen. So yeah, you know, it's you know, kind of advanced, you know, from, I know, like the earlier days in Iraq and whatnot, still using the Humvees, the turret gunner was on top, you know, but what we use what's called a MATV, this all terrain, all armored vehicle. So
okay, and you were also a medic too, right? So
yes,
I'm sure you were in a lot of situations. And again, I don't know what they all train you, but like in medic school, they obviously want you to get to your fellow man, your fellow SEAL. Keep yourself safe, but again, take care of their injury as quickly as possible. Make sure it's like less life-threatening and keep you both safe type thing.
Yeah. You know, for myself on that deployment, you know, I, you know, fortunately I only needed to utilize, you know, life-saving medical skills on two occasions, you know, so the majority of stuff was actually, you know, more clinical stuff, you know, guys getting sick or whatnot, you know, but as far as actually applying tactical medicine, you know, to save someone's life, that was just on two occasions.
Okay. May I ask, so how long in general were you a part of the SEAL team and deployments, right? They call them deployments.
Yes. I was part of the, you know, for me, I did, the way it works, you know, you go through the SEAL pipeline, you know, for me, then I went to medic school, then checked into a SEAL team. And then from there, I did two deployments at this SEAL team. And, you know, and again, I don't know what we're going to be fully getting into in this podcast, but that was where, you know, I started developing, you know, most of my career was riddled with mental health and addiction issues. And after that second platoon in particular, I was like, man, I don't, you know, I got to get out of the Navy. I got a real problem here. And so I went to what's called a shore duty. So normally after two or three platoons, you'll rotate to a shore duty where you'll be an instructor for one of the, you know, there's a plethora of commands within the SEAL teams. And then, you know, from there, so you did two platoons and two deployments at a SEAL team, went to a shore duty. And then I screened for a specialized unit within the SEAL teams.
Oh, nice.
And then, After that period, shortly thereafter is when I ended up what we called self-referring. So I had reached my, you know, proverbial rock bottom, as we put it, in recovery. And I came forward and it's like, I can't do this anymore. I need some help. And that's kind of the last, you know, year and a half of my time in the SEAL teams was this medical retirement process for myself. So that was kind of how my career unfolded.
And again, I cannot imagine like how hard it was for you to maybe go through that process. Because again, you just, again, I'm not going to act like I was ever a soldier or whatever, but just like the negative stereotypes that other military men or women or whatever will put on each other for like maybe doing something like that as a sign of weakness. Not saying that was your case or anything, but yeah.
No, it's tough. You know, they're definitely, you know, making a conceited effort to reduce that stigma, you know, and make a bigger awareness of mental health. You know, a lot of, especially in the SEAL, in the special operations community, it's just a real epidemic of suicides, fortunately. And they're certainly making an effort, but I can at least tell you, you know, anecdotally for myself, you know, I knew I needed some serious help in about 2016. But again, you know, there was, you know, you worked so hard for that goal, right? I'd wanted to be a Navy SEAL all my life. And, you know, it's like, what do I, you know, there's the fear of, you know, career ramifications. There's, you know, also your reputation is just everything. In SEAL teams, you know, what are guys going to say about me, think about me? You know, how am I going to get sidelined? You know, all these fears were keeping me sick, if you will, you know, you know, for myself personally, I tried to get help on the civilian side, seeing a therapist, paying out of pocket, you know, so the military wouldn't know about it.
Okay.
But it just, you know, as you know, Jacob, I mean, recovery, man, you gotta be all in. You can't just do it part time, you know. So it inevitably didn't work out, you know. So
is there also like a worry that you might get dishonorably discharged?
Oh yeah. So there absolutely is. So, you know, it's you know, the nice thing about, you know, I'm so blessed. I really am. And I am incredibly grateful, you know, to the Navy and how they handled my situation. And I have nothing bad to say about the military or Navy, and I'm fortunate. I know other people have not been as fortunate as I was. But for me, you know, like I had alluded to earlier, I self-referred. So that means, you know, I turned myself in, if you will, in parentheses, you know, so I didn't get in trouble. Okay. So a lot of guys, you know, of course the military, they, your analysis and, you know, guys might maybe get arrested, you know, so there's a lot of ways to get in trouble that can prompt a dishonorable discharge, you know, but in my case, you know, I really attribute it to, you know, well, for me personally, God looking out for me and continuing to do the next right thing, you know, and sticking on that recovery journey and, you know, making the right choices, because unfortunately in the military, if you relapse just once, they consider you a treatment failure. So, you know, there's no leeway or anything, you know? And so I just kept doing the next right thing, kept working my recovery program. And, you know, as I continue to, you know, have my weekly, you know, psychologist and psychiatric evaluations, they, you know, they unearthed all these other diagnoses, right? They're like, oh, this guy, he's struggling with quite a bit more than just substance abuse, you know, and that's kind of what prompted, or not kind of, it is what prompted, you know, a medical retirement as opposed to, you know, hey, let's dishonorably discharge this guy. So,
you know, and Charlie, I'm just going to say this now with all my heart, what you did took an extreme amount of courage. And I feel like you set a true example of what everyone should do to take care of themselves. It's the total opposite of being a coward. It's just like, it takes two strength and courage to do what you did to help yourself. And I applaud you for that. And I think more people need to do what you did.
Thanks, Jake. You know, that really means a lot, man. And I appreciate hearing that. And, you know, courage is one of the values that I certainly hold near and dear. And, you know, it's one that, you know, between you and me, that I honestly struggle with from time to time and seeing myself that way. So, you know, I do appreciate that sentiment. You know, that's why, you know, like I have no, you know, I'm open about my recovery for that reason, is I, if it helps just one other person, you know, muster up the strength to kind of come forward and get help, you know, because I know there's a lot of people suffering in silence like I did for yes. so long. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I also tell people, especially in my treatment center or whatever, or the average civilian, hell, man, going to a therapy session, that could scare the crap out of most people.
Yeah.
Just the first session.
Yeah, absolutely.
Another thing I kind of want to get into, Charlie, is just like your team, your SEAL team. I'm sure you look at them like your brother in arms, right? You know, the extreme camaraderie I'm sure you all had together. Throughout this process, would you guys ever, maybe like after a mission, to like blow off steam? What would that look like?
But you know, it's a high risk, high stress job, you know, and you know, unfortunately, it just I think it you know, for one, you know, I think it draws people that have, you know, addictive behaviors and tendencies to begin with, just that extreme mm-hmm. lifestyle, you know, and of course, being in that extreme, you know, there's that fight or flight mode all the time.
Yes.
It's hard, you know, you got to find those ways to decompress and mm-hmm. you know, there's healthy ways to go about it, and there's unhealthy ways, you know, and unfortunately, a lot of people, including myself, you know, for me, it was unhealthy ways. You know, I didn't cope with that stress in healthy ways. And I, you know, there's some guys that I have an incredible amount of respect and admiration for, because, you know, they relied on things such as their faith, you know, as their coping mechanism and their way to de-stress. And you know, there's other guys like myself who resorted to more harmful ways to cope with that stress. And, you know, some have found recovery, you know, gratefully, but others are still very much still struggling. So
would you see somewhat your SEAL brothers kind of struggling, or did they ever come to you and be like, hey, Charlie, man, I think I got some issues. What do you think? Yeah. Or is it all kept in secret type thing?
Well, you know, it's been really cool, Jacob, to see, you know, what we call like the SEAL brotherhood kind of at work mm-hmm. since I've gotten out, you know, and I mean, it was certainly there while I was in as well, you know. I mean, man, I don't know how many times I've always been drawn to like the idea of the helping profession. That's why I wanted to be a medic, you know, and I always kind of played that role of like the platoon shrink in a way, you know. Yeah. So guys certainly came to me with issues. And I was usually, you know, when people did become overly intoxicated, like I was usually the one to kind of calm them down, assuming I wasn't the one that was intoxicated. Yeah. Right. But, you know, no one, my time in, you know, no one came to me with a hidden, you know, drug or alcohol problem. You know, since I've been out, I mean, I've been helped by fellow teammates, have helped me immensely, and I've reached out to help other teammates. So we certainly look out for each other and try to help each other out as best as we can. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever recommend the VA for veterans, or have you ever done one of their services?
Yeah. You know, well, so I have all my care right now is done through the Minneapolis VA. And
oh, nice.
I personally have had a great experience there at the Minneapolis VA. So, you know, I know, excuse me. I know there's a lot of horror stories about the VA and you know, a lot of people speak poorly about the VA, but at least for me personally, you know, my experience there at the Minneapolis VA at least has been really good.
Yeah. Do you think that's mainly caused by like TV shows and movies sometimes portraying it a certain way?
Oh, I definitely think that contributes to it. I definitely do. And the other thing too is, you know, I think individuals sometimes don't take full ownership and responsibility too, you know, because, you know, the VA really does have a plethora of programs out there, you know, for you to take advantage of. But, you know, what's that saying? The squeaky wheel gets the grease, right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just sit idly by and expect them to reach out to you, you know? So, I've been very active in my treatment process through the VA. But yeah, I definitely, and again, I'm not saying that there's not stuff that needs to be remedied in the VA. You know, I'm sure there's plenty of things that need to be fixed, and I'm sure plenty of people have had horrible experiences, so I don't want to seem like I'm downplaying that whatsoever. But yeah, I'm sure that part of the media and all that plays a little bit into the, you know, veterans are just this forgotten population, you know. Mm-hmm. I I don't think it's a forgotten population, you know, certainly one that's struggling and needs help. And that's why it's so important to look out for each other. So.
Yeah, I'm just looking up right now. There's this movie that comes to mind, and I don't know. Have you ever seen Thank You for Your Service?
I've not, no.
Very, very good movie. I highly recommend it. Yeah, they just like kind of get into like one, like the shame for like soldiers and veterans just telling their branch they need help and that they want to use the VA services, and they make it seem like they're looked down upon and they're weak. But it also kind of demonstrates like the struggles soldiers go through just trying to get the services in general and how long it actually takes and all the paperwork they need to do and the exams and tests they have to do just to like make sure they're not faking PTSD. I mean, it's very sad.
Yeah,
you get the benefits.
I don't know, Jacob. I can't speak. I haven't seen that documentary. You know, I can only speak for my own personal process. And, you know, for me, I just, yeah, after I self-referred and said I needed some help, you know, the first thing they addressed was the substance use, you know, so they were like, okay, we got to get you to treatment. You know, we got to get you, you know, clean and sober, get a clear mind. And then it was really kind of an evaluative phase, you know, where they didn't actually, you know, diagnose me with these things until about 9 to 10 months of seeing me on a weekly basis, you know. But of course, I had the benefit that I was still in the service. And like I said, I am eternally grateful to both the Navy and the SEAL teams. My command at the time, they gave me the space and time to recover and for, you know, the system to work the way it should work, you know, to get someone the help they need. But yeah, you know, so I can't for vets that are already out and trying to, you know, go back, and I don't know what that process is like. It may, you know, so yeah, it could be incredibly hard. I you know, and I, my heart definitely goes out to them for sure.
It's just so sad where like they have to put some veterans through a process to again make sure they're not faking PTSD to get like benefits. It's just, you know, I have my own feelings towards that, you know. And actually they kind of display that in the movie too. Just again, like the barriers and difficulty these individuals need to go through just to get these services. It's really sad.
Yeah. So what are your personal thoughts on it?
I don't, it's just, there's a lot of bias because like I referring to the movie, like this like psychologist is asking this gentleman a lot of questions about like the war, the memory, like his memory about certain like things that would happen. And if anybody knows anything about trauma or biological responses to like PTSD, is that your memory is strongly affected and it's very difficult for you to like remember certain things. So again, it makes these veterans like have a difficult time taking these exams.
Okay.
From my point of view and from what I saw. So
okay.
Like in the movie, they like this, not saying this is like not all beneficial, but like the psychologist was asking the veteran, like, do you know what day it is? And he actually did not know.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the psychologist had to help him out. And then after a while, like the veteran got it right. But I guess it's also like maybe determining like other services they may need. But again, it's just like a, you know, a tough process.
Yeah, no, for sure.
So I'm just curious. So when you got out of the Navy SEALs, paint me a picture. I know you're married with kids, right?
Yes.
Were you married before or after the Navy SEALs?
I got married during.
Okay, nice. Okay. And then like when you got back, like, did your family know you were kind of struggling a little bit, or did you have to like kind of come forward to them and let them know, and this is what I need and that? And
yeah, no. Let's see. So how did this all unfold? You know, I remember the first person I told, you know, so for a long time, you know, I didn't even know I was an addict, you know.
Okay.
I've explained this before, and you know, like for a long time, to me, using was purely survival based. Like, and what I mean by that is, you know, I was like, I need these substances for in order to not want to end my life, you know, to sleep at night, to you know, calm the inner critic, to find some relief from my anxiety, my depression, and it you know, but it took a long time until I finally realized I had a problem. And I want to say that, you know, maybe a year after that, it was when I finally told my wife. And so it kind of popped on the radar. But it wasn't until I, you know, it, I want to say I even, so kind of how my story unfolded, you know, my, so for me, you know, I got to preface this with, you know, none of my opinions represent Hazelden at all. Okay. I just started, you know, I don't,
great school.
Yeah, I don't represent, you know, the counseling profession whatsoever. Everything I know about recovery is isolated to the 12-step fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. So just keep that in mind when I speak, you know, my opinions are just my own. But, you know, I agree with that model that, you know, addiction is NA's perspective, that it's a disease of, you know, personality, attitudes, general negative outlook that's rooted in, you know, I believe they say, fear, insecurity, and low self-esteem. So to me, that's what the disease of addiction is. And, you know, substance use is simply a symptom of it, you know, and so for me, I had my drug of choice, right? Which for me was opiates. But you know, when I couldn't find opiates, it didn't matter. You know, I would always find something, you know. And so the way it kind of unfolded for me is you know, I remember I reached the peak of my problem with opiates. And I remember coming clean and, you know, telling my family, I wrote, and now it's coming back to me. I wrote an email. I wrote an email to my mom, my dad, and my brother. And I told them that I had a problem with pain pills. Because, you know, at that time, and of course, you know, I didn't know anything about addiction at the time. I just knew that I had a serious problem. I could not go more than you know, 8 hours without, utilizing a pain pill without getting sick, you know, and, it was spending an inordinate amount of money every day to facilitate my usage. And it had just gotten out of control. And it was only a matter of time before I was going to get busted, you know? And, so that was when, you know, I referred to earlier, I was like, all right, I need some help. And I saw that civilian therapist. But then what happened was, I discovered this drug called Kratom. Have you ever heard of Kratom?
I have.
Okay. So Kratom is this leaf that's native to, I want to say Southeast or Southwest Asia, like, you know, it's legal here in some states in the U.S., not every state. Like it happens to be legal here in Minnesota. You can buy it at different head shops.
Huh.
And, it has an almost identical effect to opiates. Especially when ingested in large quantities. And, you know, so when I found this drug, initially, I thought this was a miracle. I was like, I just cured my addiction because, you know, I found a cheaper alternative. It gave me the same high. It kept me from getting sick, but it wasn't quite as detrimental as the Roxycontins that I was currently hooked on. Okay. No. So what it did was it gave me a false sense of manageability. And you know, that's where my career, I started to think, you know what, maybe I can continue to be a SEAL. And that was when I actually was like, you know what, I can screen for this unit within the SEAL teams that's very difficult to screen for. And, you know, I started to, like I said, that false sense of manageability. So it wasn't until, you know, all this time, my family thought that I was clean and sober off these pills when really, I was ingesting massive amounts of Kratom every single day for, you know, about 4 years, you know, and then it wasn't until I was actually in the psychiatric ward after my self-referral for you know, detox, when I called them from that phone and was like, hey, you know, got to come clean again for the second time. I've actually been using this thing called Kratom every day for the last 4 years, and I really haven't been clean, you know. And so to answer your question, I know that was a long-winded response.
No,
but that's kind of how it unfolded for me. And, you know, now it's just, you know, recovery is kind of the cornerstone of my life since being out of the military.
I could assume, like, was Kratom a lot cheaper than opioids too, I'm assuming?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, Jacob, when I was, you know, at the height of my problem, at least in San Diego, you know, I was spending $300 to $400 a day to sustain my opiate habit. I mean, I got an $80,000 reenlistment bonus from Afghanistan. Wow. Yeah, for being a medic, and I blew through that before I even knew it, man. And but then with the Kratom, it was financially way more sustainable. And then also it has a much longer half-life than you know, the quick acting Roxycontins do. And so what that meant was, and I know, I'm sure you know how, you know, what half-life means is, yeah, you know, I could take a relatively small dose in the mornings and it would keep me stable throughout the day, keep me from getting withdrawal symptoms, keep me from getting sick. And then I would take my larger doses in the evening to get the high I was looking for, you know, to, you know, or what we call as recovering, you know, the nod, get your nod going off, you know, and it would just that, because of that long half-life, it would stay in my system enough to where I could, you know, still work out, still perform my job relatively well, you know, do all of those functions. So again, I just use that term. It was a false sense of manageability. You know, I thought on paper, my life looked manageable. But it's like, that's what I love about, you know, the first step of Narcotics Anonymous in the literature. It says that social acceptability does not equal recovery. And at this time on paper, my life looked very socially acceptable, you know, but really deep down, you know, there was this moral, this spiritual, this emotional, mental bankruptcy that existed, this void. So,
yeah, that's very interesting. Just going back, so when all this like drug issues started to happen, did they mainly happen while you were a SEAL, or did you know you might have had issues prior to becoming a SEAL?
That's a good question. So, you know, my whole childhood, it was focused on becoming a Navy SEAL. I did not have your typical high school experience, man. There were no parties, no girlfriends. I didn't go to homecoming or prom or any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, so my first drink wasn't until, you know, I want to say I was somewhere in between SEAL training, but, you know, and again, I don't want to sound like a broken record. I'm going to quote some of the NA literature again, but it says, that many of us believe we're addicts long before we first use. And I really believe that. I really believe I had a real proclivity to be an addict. And I say that because my downward spiral happened pretty quick. Like I said, there was no drinking, no drug use prior to the Navy. All I do remember though, is that one time when I had my wisdom teeth taken out, I do remember being prescribed, you know, Vicodin or Percocet or something. And I remember I wouldn't take it during the day. I would just kind of suck up the pain during the day, but then I would take it at night so that I would sleep all right. And I just remember enjoying the feeling that it gave me. And I remember that when it finally ran out, I remember having just a terrible night's sleep, just being incredibly anxious and restless. Mm-hmm. And I even remember like consciously having the thought at that young age, like, wow, that stuff is powerful. Like I probably shouldn't ever do that again. Like, I don't want another bad night's sleep like that. And, but then, for me, it happened quick, man. I just, I want to say like I had my first beer, it was all right. But when I did kind of start to drink, it happened. I just noticed that, like, I always drank really fast. Like instead of just sipping on one beer, I'd have three or four beers really quickly. And then like, it kind of quickly spiraled into, you know, vodka. And then, I was introduced to recreational, opiates, you know, and it just was this, and then being a medic, I was always surrounded with narcotics. You know, I always had access to narcotics, and it's just, it was something that was always around me. So that was kind of how my usage unfolded.
Yeah, and you always hear about the other avenue where clients get hooked up. I personally have had a few clients that, for them, it started with like a broken leg or a broken arm, and then they'd get prescribed opioids by a doctor, and over time they'd get prescribed too much or they wouldn't take it appropriately, and that's when they would get hooked. And then everyone's story is different, but sometimes they would say like the doctor stopped prescribing them, so then they would have to go out on the streets and get heroin off the streets, which is almost identical. There's always like really hard pass down in life. And so like when you got out and you admitted your issues and everything like that, did you know like NA was going to be a great thing for you and you just started going to NA meetings right away?
That's a great question. So I did not, you know, my treatment required us, we went to meetings every night in treatment. So our treatment was actually, modeled off of the Hazelden Betty Ford model.
Oh, okay.
At least like every PowerPoint we ever did, it always had the logo of Hazelden Betty Ford on there. And we did like an online module program that said Hazelden Betty Ford. So as far as I know, it was like based off of that model. And so we went to meetings every night. But now when I was in treatment, Jacob, you know, I just like many, many recovering addicts and alcoholics, I just was surviving, you know, I just trying to survive, right? Just,
yep.
You know, the meetings were just, you know, something that I had to do, you know? And for me, when I got out of treatment, I was scared to death to leave treatment. I actually stayed longer than I needed to, out of pure fear. I was afraid I was going to go back to using it, and I didn't want to. And so I picked right back up with meetings just for the sole purpose that it was part of my routine. So I'm a huge routine oriented person, and my routine is one of those things that really kind of keeps me stable. And so I just kind of kept going to meetings. And, you know, it wasn't until, you know, probably five months of being clean that I finally, you know, got a sponsor and really started to actually recognize, you know, like what I always tell people is that, you know, the 12-step fellowships are a program. You know, it's not just, for a long time, I thought it was just meetings. You know, I thought you just go to this meeting for an hour a day and that's it. But, you know, oh, there's so much more to it. Until I got a sponsor, I didn't know that. And once I got a sponsor, that was when everything changed. That was when, you know, he introduced me to the steps and the service work and to all of these concepts that make up a 12-step program. And then that was where I kind of went all in with the NA.
The thing I like is also just the community involvement and the fellowship aspect.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask, like, how was your wife through this process? Was she like supportive in a sense and always there with you? And
oh, yeah. I mean, geez, it's, you know, bless her heart. I mean, it's, she's been through a lot, you know. She has been, I don't know how she could be any more supportive than she has been, but that's not to say that it hasn't been easy. I mean, yeah, it has been a roller coaster for her, especially, you know, and it's hard because, you know, when you're in recovery, you know, like recovery has to be your number one priority, and it has to come before everything else. And it's like, you know, how do you, you know, be a good husband, a good father, you know, a good man, a good woman when, you know, something else has to be the priority in your life, you know? So it certainly has been a learning experience for both of us, but, no, she definitely has been very supportive of everything from the beginning.
Amen. And you have a son?
One son and one daughter.
Whoa, nice. How old are they?
So my daughter is 8 and my son is 5.
Okay, so they're in elementary school, huh? All right. Cool. So now I would like to transition to, like, what made you be like, hey, I want to be a therapist now. I want to go to Hazelden and complete the program.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, I always had this idea of the helping, I think empathy and compassion has always been a trait of mine. So like, you know, here's like a little, I almost backed out of the Navy. So about 2 months before I joined, one morning, I'll never forget, I'm like sitting in my basement and this thought comes across my head. Like, what if I don't make it, you know, like what if I quit, you know? 'Cause you know, I mean, Jacob, we started our indoc with 240 guys, you know, that had all been vetted and made it through pre-buds and all the screening. And, you know, those 240, we finished with 13 originals at the very end, you know, so people get added, rolled into your class, but 13 of those original 240. And, you know, so it's not, you know, I'm just putting the statistics out there. It's statistically, you're more likely to not make it through training. And, you know, it like hit my mind this one morning. And I'm like, I've told all these people that I'm going to be a Navy SEAL and they're all counting on me. And, you know, what happens if I don't make it? And I got overwhelmed with anxiety, but I didn't know it was anxiety at the time, you know, but for me, my anxiety is really manifest physically. So I just, you know, I was so nauseous, I couldn't eat, you know, or sometimes I'd even throw up and I couldn't sleep and I lost all this weight, you know, and I almost backed out and I was like, what am I going to do? And I started to look at becoming a psychologist. Like that was what interests me. So I'm just pointing this out that it was like, it was something that was, in on my radar, you know, even kind of prior to joining. I guess you could say it was like my backup plan in a sense.
Yeah.
You know? And then I think just kind of my natural like inclination to want to help and be a healer, you know, with like the medic thing you know, this is something that like I still my ego still struggles with very much, is because, you know, to me, you know, the ultimate definition of a man is, you know, to be this, you know, warrior, fighter, you know, tip of the spear and all these things. I'm kind of having to come to this acceptance in my life of, you know, I just have to accept the fact that I'm more of a lover than a fighter, I think, if that makes sense. And
Yeah.
I've had my whole life to prove to myself that I'm a fighter, and I've gone to extreme lengths of misery to prove to myself that I'm a fighter. But I really think my heart is with helping people. You know, man, just like in treatment, you know, I thrived off of just, I was always known as the quietest guy, you know, throughout my whole SEAL career. But finally being in the treatment environment and talking and opening up, and like I just love being there for other people. And like everyone wanted to work out with me in treatment because they knew I was a SEAL. And so I would run these workouts, and everyone
Oh, nice.
would do the, you know, so like I got that, you know, just like helping people and like seeing people reach their goals and like motivating them and inspiring them. Like that was what really kind of fueled me and kind of, you know, piqued my interest. And then, you know, it came time, you know, it certainly has not been easy transitioning, from the service, you know, and it kind of came time where it's like, you know, man, I gotta at least start putting my feet forward in some direction here. And, you know, I love sponsoring people in Fellowship of NA. And so I was like, you know what, man, the closest thing to, you know, being a paid sponsor is kind of like a counselor, you know, and although I know they're very much different things. But so yeah, that was kind of what prompted me to be like, you know what, let's pull the trigger on this and you know, see where it goes. So
Absolutely. Any particular reason you chose Hazleton? If you don't mind asking.
you know, I think I just had always heard about Hazelden
Yeah.
as kind of being a internationally recognized institution. And then, you know, I went to tour the school, and it was kind of crazy because I drive up there and I actually see the Nicholas Spihar Navy SEAL Memorial Highway on the way up there. You know, so here's this small, you know, small podunk, random, you know, small town in the middle of Minnesota,
Center City.
yeah, you know, and here's this Navy SEAL highway, you know, Nicholas Spihar, he was one of the SEALs that was killed in extortion, which was the largest loss of life in special operations history. So it was August 6, 2011, when helicopters being shot down in Afghanistan. And you know, not to go off topic here, but I actually just recently got to spend time with his dad, who's an incredible human being. And he actually has a brother that happens to work at Hazelden, and just all these things.
Oh.
To answer your question, it was kind of like a spiritual thing. Like all these, like the stars were just kind of lining, and I really just the faculty there, everyone was so friendly, and it had that small community feel, which I really enjoyed, because my last year of high school, I'm very much an introvert. In my last year of high school, I did what's called the PSEO program, and so
Okay.
I actually got to go to the University of Minnesota for
Oh,
my classes.
nice.
But I hated it there. It was just
Oh.
so big and so many people, and I just was so uncomfortable. And I liked just the small community feel of Hazelden. So that was why I chose Hazelden.
I've actually never been there. But it looks beautiful. It absolutely looks beautiful.
No, it really is.
No, that's great. And again, I'm so happy for you going on this journey. And you're going through your first semester now, or are you done with your first semester?
I just wrapped up my first semester. So, yep, start the second semester this coming week.
Excellent, excellent. And again, man, like I wish you nothing but the best. And as we wind up, I like asking people like their goals, like in the next 5 years, like what do you hope to accomplish if you can kind of put that into words, you know?
Yeah, you know, like I just want to, you know, I want to know that I'm making a difference. That's my goal in these next 5 years. You know, I you know, I just, yeah, I want to know that I'm helping, you know, I'm helping people, making a difference, that, you know, my life, my job, there's purpose, there's meaning, you know, that's really kind of my goal. You know, of course there's the more objective goal of, you know, okay, I want to graduate from Hazelden, you know, and, at some point from a higher educational perspective, I think I'd like to, you know, get a PhD. Like there's those, nice. More objective goals, but really the overarching, you know, kind of subjective goal for me is like, I want to know that I'm making a difference in some regard, you know, some way that's tangible. So.
Would you ever maybe, and again, I'm just throwing out ideas cause I'm kind of interested in this too, yeah. But like, maybe having your own facility specializing in PTSD or veterans.
I mean, I would love to,
that'd be cool.
I would love to work with other veterans, you know, cause, you know, I actually just recently sent my resume in to a company that works with military and first responders. And, you know, when I, after my inpatient stint, I went right into an IOP that was actually run by a former Navy SEAL in recovery. And it was just for military. And I really enjoyed that kind of setting. So no, it would be incredible to be able to specifically work with veterans and, you know, cause I just, you know, I mean, for me, you know, I want to just help anyone I can help, you know, I mean, all the people that I sponsor, you know, none of them are veterans, you know, but it certainly is, you know, I see it in so many of my buddies. I mean, it's just such an epidemic, such a problem right now within, you know, I guess I can only speak for the special operations community. I can't speak so much for the conventional forces, but I only assume that they experience the same type of difficulties. But, you know, it's just, yeah, you know, I feel like every week I'm hearing about, another issue with one of my teammates. So it's definitely a problem out there. And I think, you know, it helps when you are able to relate on a unique level with the patients, you know, cause especially, you know, in special operations, I mean, we have egos the size of Mount Everest, you know, like I think we're the greatest thing, you know, the greatest gift out there when, you know, we're, you know, I'm exaggerating a little bit, you know, like, but you know, a lot of times, you know, the having someone that can relate to those guys and be like, you know, hey man, like I've been in your shoes and you know, I you're not alone in this struggle, and kind of being able to pull at those cords, those strings, you know, that maybe someone else that didn't live that experience might not be able to, you know, so.
Absolutely. And Charlie, man, I know you're obviously passionate about helping people. Your story just right now, I know is going to help so many people. Just listening what you went through and your perseverance is truly amazing. And again, I'm just so blessed having you on the show.
Yeah, no, it's like I say, I was humbled when you asked me, and you know, I hope that you know, like I said, I'm very open about my recovery for that sole reason that you know, I hope it can help someone, you know, and it's you know, as you know, recovery is not an easy process, and you know, especially in the beginning, I, you know, so much shame and so much guilt, and you know, you know, oh man, what are all my teammates going to think of me, and, yeah. And what's my reputation now? And I take some just peace in knowing that, you know, if I just honestly convey my story and it helps just one person, it can kind of, make up for some of that pent up shame and guilt. And, yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to just share one more thing with you. Is that
absolutely.
Okay? You know, I just, anytime I've shared my story in a forum, you know, like I've always ended it with this, and I did not come up with the saying. Okay. So I'm not trying to take credit for it here, but, you know, don't quit 5 seconds before the miracle, you know, like if someone that is struggling is listening to this today, that would be the one thing I would say is don't quit 5 seconds before the miracle. And, you know, I've almost been there. And, you know, if there's one thing that, you know, SEAL training taught me is that, you know, all pain and suffering it comes to an end, you know, and what makes the difference between, you know, the people that make it in SEAL training and the people that quit is the people that quit don't see an end to that suffering. And I know how hard it can be. Mm-hmm. And I've certainly been there in my life where I thought there was no end to the suffering, but you know, everything eventually passes. And I have almost quit before the miracle happens. And, you know, I use the analogy that, you know, in SEAL training, there's a bell and, you know, it's just part of the history. And when you quit in SEAL training, you have to ring the bell 3 times. And then you set your helmet down on the, what's called the grinder, and all these helmets line up the grinder. So, you know, every day you go by the grinder, you see all the helmets of all the people that have rung the bell and quit. And you know, the bell is always there. The option to quit is always there. And Hell Week, the bell follows you around wherever you go. You know, they bring it on a truck. And so you can ring the bell at, you know, at any point. And, you know, at those moments in training, you know, those times where, you know, you're hypothermic, you're so cold and you just don't know, you're so exhausted, you don't know how you can make it another second longer. You know, I would just tell myself, you know, just make it to the next meal, just make it to the next minute. I mean, there were times where, you know, I remember being on conditioning runs and just picking out a point in the sand and just telling myself, just make it to that next point, man, just make it to that next point. And then I would get to that point and I'd be like, just make it to the next one, and breaking it down just like that. And, you know, eventually at some point that suffering, that pain, it ends, you know, and you have that feeling of, you know, you just accomplished something hard. You just made it through, and, you know, you build those mental calluses, if you will. And that's how you forge that mental toughness and become stronger and build that belief and confidence in yourself. And I use that analogy because I experienced it in my own recovery. You know, there was a point in my recovery where I almost quit, you know, but like I said, thankfully I didn't, because it was, mm-hmm. you know, it would have been 5 seconds before the miracle happened. And, you know, recovery really is a miracle. I've always said that, you know, I learned more about becoming a man in recovery than in my time in special operations, you know, and I mean the term man, woman as well, just, you know, what recovery teaches you is being a person of values, and not just establishing your values, but living by your values, you know, and being the person that you truly want to be in life. Like, that's the gift that recovery has given me, the freedom from addiction. And, you know, I'm eternally grateful for it. And I just pray that, all those people struggling out there that they can find that same point someday. So, thank you, Jacob.
Amen. That was beautifully said, Charlie. It really was. Before we end things, if any of my audience members want to get a hold of you, Charlie, is there a particular email or if your LinkedIn or whatnot they could use to, again, message you if they have any questions for you?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, what do people usually do for this? I mean,
email's fine. Or if you want to, I can always give them your LinkedIn information if that's okay. Or
yeah. I mean, do you have my email, right?
I believe so. Or I could probably find it on your LinkedIn, right? Or.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, I mean, my email is just firstname.lastname@gmail.com. Either that or LinkedIn, you know, whatever works for me. Yeah.
Absolutely, man. That works out great. And to all my audience members, again, I'll just put that in my show notes. So it'll be one click away.
Okay.
And again, Charlie, man, I had so much fun learning about you and your story recovery, man. It was a blast.
Yeah, well, thanks, Jacob. Again, I was humbled you asked me, and it was great to meet you. And again, you know, I thank you for your service being in the helping professions, man. I mean, this is a real problem out there, and it takes a special kind of person to dedicate their life to helping other people. So, you know, thank you for that.
Much appreciated. Thank you. I again want to thank Charlie for being an awesome and amazing guest on my show. I had a blast working with him. I just want to thank all of my listeners for your support. And just to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. And if anyone has any further questions for me, you can reach me at my email address, behaviorhealthintegration121@gmail.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Jacob Minig, where you will find more educational posts on psychotherapy, trauma, and addiction. And finally, you can follow me on my website, which is behaviorhealthintegration.org.
I also want to inform everyone that there is a great new device out there called Comigo. It's a breathing device meant to control and manage your breathing rates and the depth of your breathing as you inhale and exhale to, again, help relieve any type of anxiety and stress-like symptoms. And if you do put the BHI podcast into the promo code, you get $30 off this amazing device. It is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and you will not be disappointed. All right, everyone. Until next time, have a good day. Bye.